Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, migrant apprehensions surged to over 130,000 people last month in May along the southwestern border. That makes nearly 600,000 for all of 2019, two-thirds of which are family units or unaccompanied children. That sheer number of people, most presenting themselves to authorities asking for asylum along the border, is taxing the immigration system to its limits. President Trump has responded by threatening Mexico with tariffs unless it diminishes the flow of migrants, most of whom are from Central America. Now a tentative agreement is in place. My guest today says while the situation at the border is unusual, it's hardly unique. Lebanon has received over 1 million refugees from neighboring Syria. Germany received over 1.4 million refugees over 3 years from various parts of the Middle East, including Syria. Colombia, Peru, and Brazil have received 4 million refugees from Venezuela, with another million on the way. James Holofield says migration has long been with us, as is the reaction to it, the rise of nativist sentiment, both here in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere. Holofield is one of the leading experts on migration policy here in the United States and Europe. He's a professor of political science at SMU, Southern Methodist University, and director of the Tower Center there. He's served as an advisor to a number of governments, the United Nations, the World Bank, and the Inter-American Development Bank. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking about the administration's migration policies, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. James Holofield, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
Before we talk about the larger issue of migration, let's talk about the current conflict between the U.S. and Mexico over the huge influx of Central American migrants seeking asylum at the southern border. While the threat of tariffs has seems to momentarily subsided, how can Mexico control this flow? What does the U.S. expect from Mexico in this situation?
Well, the short answer is it's going to be very hard for Mexico, as it would be for any country, to control a spontaneous movement of people this big. And I say spontaneous. It's gotten a lot more organized over the years because, as we know, people are moving in caravans. And the drivers of this migration are very powerful. I think everybody knows about the violence in the Northern Triangle countries. Many people are just desperate to survive, you know. So, and when people are that desperate, they're going to move one way or another. But I think something your listeners might not be aware of is a lot of this is just family migration. It's family driven. I mean, a lot of these people have family in the U.S. who've been here for 20, 30 years or more. So they're coming trying to find their family members in the U.S. So these are very powerful drivers. And, you know, until you can address some of the root causes related to this migration, it's going to be hard to control it. And, you know, the southern border of Mexico, the Guatemalan border, is a fairly open border. And, you know, just think about how difficult it's been for us to control our southern border. We have a lot more resources and a lot more personnel to do this. For Mexico, this is just, you know, this is a new challenge, I think. But they're trying, and they're stopping people after they've crossed the border 5-10 miles in, trying to catch them on the roads coming up through Mexico. But I think it's important also to keep in mind that the Mexicans have been quite cooperative with us for a long time in trying to control the flows of Central Americans. If you go back into the Obama administration, there was another surge back then of Central Americans. And I actually know the U.S. ambassador to Mexico at the time, a man named Tony Wayne, Ambassador Wayne, who's a great guy, and how hard he worked behind the scenes quietly through diplomacy, you know, to stop the people from getting on the train. You remember the Beast and all the people who were coming north. So the Mexicans have done this, and they're trying as best they can to help and to work with us on controlling this movement of people.
So they're offering new ideas to help control the flow. How successful do you think they'll be?
Well, I mean, this is a process. You know, as I said, this goes back at least 10 or 15 years. So the Mexicans have, you know, tried to respect the Geneva Convention, you know, to help manage the process of people coming and seeking asylum. And a lot of Central Americans are now staying in Mexico and seeking asylum there. But as I said earlier, many of these people, their goal is to get to the United States, you know, because that's where their families are. And, of course, if you can get across the border or get to the U.S. border under the convention, the Refugee Convention, You have a right to request asylum, you know, and Mexico and the United States are parties to this convention. So the Mexicans are, you know, keeping more of the asylum seekers in Mexico as they wait for a hearing in the United States. The Mexicans, as I said, are, you know, trying harder to enforce their southern border. But again, this is a fairly large flow of people. It is a humanitarian crisis. So just trying to take care of this many people. But Mexico has said it will do it, that it is stepping up. And they've said that, you know, prior to the threat of tariffs. So I think this is going to be an ongoing process. And I do think the Mexicans are trying hard to cooperate with the U.S.
And I guess our policy goal is for this flow of people to stop.
Well, eventually it will stop. And this is what I think a lot of people don't realize. The population of the Northern Triangle countries is about 32 million people. And only a fraction of those people are moving. It seems like right now that this is a large number of people, and it is a relatively large number of people, but it is a manageable number of people. If we work with the Mexicans and others, we will be able to manage these flows. If, you know, the U.S. takes, you know, well over a million people as migrants coming into this country legally every year. You know, we have a very, very tight labor markets here. You know, our economy is so big and so powerful. You know, we can absorb large numbers of migrants, even in a fairly short period of time. I would just remind your listeners what the Germans accomplished in 2015 and 16 when they had over a million people suddenly arrived on their borders. And everybody understood that that was a true humanitarian crisis. The Germans and the Europeans, in spite of all the political problems, you know, they managed that. I think the U.S. is and Mexico are capable of managing this. And eventually this flow of people will exhaust itself. I know it's hard for people to get their minds around that. But in the 80s and 90s, we took millions of Mexicans coming here. The Mexicans are going home now. So that flow has reversed. So it's negative. The Central Americans are coming, but eventually this flow will stop too.
Certainly, the United States is capable of handling this level of refugees mm-hmm. on the southern border, but there seems to be very much an unwillingness to handle that.
Well, I mean, I would just say that this is a humanitarian crisis. I want to make that clear. And there are a lot of challenges in trying to cope with, you know, these numbers of people, just finding them a place to live and put a roof over their head and make sure that they're taken care of. And we've seen all the challenges, especially with respect to the children. But this is a political crisis more than anything else. And we can see that migration has become, you know, a huge political football in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world. So there's a big symbolic dimension to all of this. And, you know, the media has played its role in this. I mean, this all makes for very good copy. So, you know, if you can point to these large caravans, you know, this gets people's attention. But I want to remind your listeners that if you look at migration globally, there are about 250 million people in the world who live outside of their country of birth. Now, that sounds like a lot of people, but it's about 3.5% of the world's population. So you have to remember the vast majority of the people in the world, they're not migrating. They're not moving. And you have to distinguish between migration and mobility. You know, migration, you're moving somewhere with an endpoint, possibly with the goal of settling there. But, you know, there's a natural flow of mobility of people. And in any given day, you know, millions and millions of people move across borders all over the world. The total mobility of people is about 2 billion people annually crossing borders. But most of those people, that's just a natural flow of people. So it's important to keep this in perspective. You know, historically, you know, we're at high numbers, but still the vast majority of people in the world don't move. Migration is the exception, not the rule.
You have to sort of put yourself in their shoes. Yep. What would it take yep. for you to leave your country yep. forever, go to another country where you're not going to speak the language, you know, your job prospects are foggy at best?
Yep. Yeah.
You know, what would it take for you to do that and then put yourself in those folks'
let's
shoes?
Just think this through for a moment analytically. I think everybody can understand what we used to call the old push-pull dynamic. And, you know, if people want to know why Mexicans started migrating to the United States, The answer to that is pretty simple. We went there, we recruited them, and we brought them here to work, starting in the 30s, but then with the Bracero program. So there is a huge demand pull with respect to migration. And that's what got Mexicans in the habit of coming to work in the United States. We needed them, especially during the Second World War when we didn't have enough labor. All the young men were off fighting the war, so we pulled in Mexicans. But once we had started this flow of people, the Mexican population itself, like the Central American population today, you know, sort of exploded. So you went from a demand pull, suddenly you've got large populations of very young people with no real prospects for employment in Mexico or in Central America. So now you've got supply push. So in a market, it's, you know, demand and supply, it's pull and it's push. But the thing that makes this work, that makes these markets work, and this goes back to your question, you really need networks. And those networks, you can think of them as kinship networks. To be a little bit technical about this, they lower the transaction costs of the move. They lower the risks of the move. I mentioned that many of these people have family here. If you have family and you know where you're going and, you know, your father is there or your mother is there, or you got a brother or someone or a sister who will take care of you, a church, for example. So there are very well-organized communities here, diaspora communities. And the networks, you know, they're like two poles of a battery. They connect the demand and the supply, and they make it much more efficient. But those are three. That's what I call the necessary conditions for people to make the move. If you've got those conditions fulfilled, people will move. But the sufficient conditions go back to the law. They go back to politics. They go back to policy. Ultimately, you have to create a space for these people to come, to live, to work. They need work permits. And, of course, eventually they may want to naturalize and become citizens. So don't forget how important policy is in this story. And in the United States, unfortunately, we really failed abysmally because we had this very powerful economy and a powerful market for migrant labor. But we didn't create enough visas. We didn't create enough green cards. So what we ended up with was a bad situation with 10 to 12 million people who were living in this country without documents, who are working in the country illegally. And that undermines our society. It undermines our social contract. It undermines the rule of law. But that was a problem that we had with our policy. I mean, the employers desperately needed these people to come and work, and the employers still need these people to come and work. If you look at the American labor market, there are lots of immigrants on the low end of the labor market doing basic manpower, basic, you know, labor, construction, healthcare. I mean, I'm sure your listeners have seen the construction sites. They've been in hospitals, and you look at who's taking care of the elderly and the sick. It's very often immigrants who are doing this. So we need them on the low end, and of course, we'd be crazy not to try to recruit and retain the smartest people. So, you know, we get a lot of immigrants on the high and the low end. But if our policies are not set up, you know, to allow the market to operate at some level, then we're just shooting ourselves in the foot.
My guest today is James Hollifield, a professor of political science and director of the Tower Center at SMU, Southern Methodist University. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on Back to the Future, Trump's Migration Policies, and the New Nativism. Well, that policy you're talking about has been a long time failure, you know, and it doesn't look like we're going to get any sort of cohesion towards at least a common ground policy anytime soon.
Well, no. If anything, as I said, we're going back to the future. We're sort of regressing. I think there's Trump has led a push, a sort of an America First policy, which is really sort of trying to take us back to the 1920s in many ways. You know, an era which was defined by a mercantilism, a protectionism, anti-free trade. But the 1920s, that's the decade I would really compare this with, was also a decade when we had a big surge in nativism, the most draconian anti-immigration laws that we ever adopted in our history with a national origins quota system that was put in place in 1924. So there is definitely a nativist backlash going on in the United States. And if you look back historically, every major wave of immigration, there have been four major waves of immigration in American history. The first wave is what brought some of my ancestors here from the British Isles. We tend not to think about the first wave because, you know, some people like my late colleague Sam Huntington at Harvard called that the settlement wave, you know, which was a white Anglo-Saxon Puritan Protestant wave of people. Of course, the Native Americans were the big losers in that. But then the second wave came later in the mid-19th century, and those were largely Germans and, of course, the Irish. And there was a big nativist backlash against that influx of people because they were Roman Catholic. So we had the Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s, you know, which was a group that eventually folded into what became the modern Republican Party. And the Republican Party has been pretty nativist, pretty anti-immigrant from its early history. It's also been a party that's always been quite protectionist. It was known at one point, its nickname was the Party of the Tariff. Even Abraham Lincoln said, you know, there's one thing I won't compromise on, it's the tariff, you know. But just remember, we didn't have any national or federal immigration laws until the 1880s. The first federal law we had was in 1882, and it these nativist pushes came largely from California. And this push was against the Chinese. So we passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, which eventually covered all people from Asia, especially East Asia, including the Japanese. They were banned from immigrating or settling in the United States. That was our first federal immigration law. But that didn't stop the big third wave of immigration, you know, which started in the 1880s, 1890s. And that was still, in proportional terms, that was still the largest immigration wave in American history. You know, this brought in people from Southern Europe, from Eastern Europe, more Roman Catholics. This is when you had large Jewish migration coming into the U.S. from Russia, Poland, and elsewhere. And then, of course, we had the big nativist backlash against that in the 1920s.
That was the law that you were talking about.
And
was passed in 1924.
We passed the National Origins Quota Law in 1924, which basically shut down immigration. I won't get into the technicalities of how that law worked, but it's a law that that really just put the quietus on immigration into the United States in the 1920s. And then you had the Great Depression, you know, which really just shut it down. And then you had the Second World War. So, I mean, people don't move, you know, or they're fleeing as refugees. You know, we saw, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Jews fleeing who were turned away from American shores, by the way, in the 1930s. We sent many of them back to their deaths. But it wasn't, you know, immigration in the U.S. didn't recover until really the 1970s or even the 1980s. And at this point in time, of course, the pattern of Mexican migration into the U.S. was well established through the Bracero program. So Mexicans, you know, eventually Central Americans would replace Europeans. And today, again, this may come as a surprise to your listeners out there, but migration from Latin America will soon be over. I mean, the Northern Triangle countries in Central America, like Mexico, they are going through a big demographic transition. The birth rates have dropped and collapsed. I think in El Salvador, the birth rates are lower than they are in the U.S. So there are not going to be any more people coming from there pretty soon. So the immigrants of the future, we've already seen this, they're coming from Asia. You know, Asia has for many years replaced Latin America as a primary source of immigration, both South Asia in particular, Southeast Asia, lots of Filipinos here, lots of Indians, Bangladeshis, and others coming. And of course, Africa. You know, Africa is the one place on the planet where you still have a lot of very young people who don't have the opportunities that they need to succeed in life. Many of the Africans will continue to go to Europe because there's where the colonial ties are, and it's closer, obviously. But Africa will be the source of immigration for the foreseeable future.
You're talking about birth rates declining and collapsing in a lot of these places where immigration is an issue.
Yeah.
Will we see a day where those migrants will be actually desired because of the collapsing birth rates throughout the industrialized West?
Yeah.
And any place with a good economy, you've seen birth rates decline to the point where many places it's below replacement value.
Well, this is already happening. It's going to happen sooner than we think. It may come as a shock to think about this, but our societies are very stagnant demographically. Some of them are in full-scale decline. You know, I wrote
certainly Western Europe, any of the countries
well,
in Western
Europe. Well, in Europe, Japan,
yes.
It's very, very dramatic in Japan. You know, I've spent a lot of time in Japan, worked there and in Europe. And these are societies where the birth rates have long since fallen below replacement level. They, in some cases, they're barely one child per woman. So, but these are still dynamic societies. I mean, it's not as if Japan is going down a black hole. It's still a very rich and powerful economy, and they desperately need people. They need workers. You know, it's a rapidly aging society. So I wrote an article about this in a journal called The International Relations of the Asia-Pacific, if your viewers want to look this up, called Japan as an Emerging Migration State. This was about a year or two ago. And I said, you know, Japan has got to get its mind around having immigrants. A lot of my colleagues said, you know, it's not going to happen. But within less than a year, the Japanese government passed a law taking in another almost half a million guest workers. One country where the birth rates have collapsed, and this is, again, going to be quite a shock, is China.
Yes.
The Chinese are also going to need people. So, you know, I don't know if it will happen in our lifetimes, but we are going to see a situation where it's not just competition for the best educated and highly skilled. There's going to be a basic competition for people and a need for workers. So the countries, the societies that step up to this issue, that come up with policies that allow people to come and work legally and pull, you know, the most talented people into their societies, those are the societies that are going to flourish. Don't forget, when you look at migrants, these people are highly self-selected. I mean, it's not the poor and downtrodden of these societies that move, because moving is complicated, it's expensive, you have to make very careful calculations. So the misconception, you know, that migrants are the dregs, that they're the worst, that's simply not true. I mean, economists have demonstrated this over time. I often like to quote the former president of the United States, George W. Bush, you know, who tried to push for a comprehensive immigration reform only to have it shot down in the Congress. But he came up with an expression which I think we need to go back to and think about, which is we need to find a way to match willing workers with willing employers. You know, if we can come up with a system that will allow the market to function, all of our societies are going to be better off. They're going to be healthier. They're going to be more dynamic. So as bad as this current quote-unquote crisis with the Central Americans is, you know, we're going to need these people. And, you know, the sooner we get our minds around that, I think the better off we will be.
My guest today is James Hollifield. He is a professor of political science and director of the Tower Center at Southern Methodist University, specialist on migration, and was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. Well, if there's one issue that is as contentious as immigration in the United States, it's climate change. And this is also playing a role in migration. You've seen it already in Africa. You're beginning to see it. I think there's a thought that a lot of the Central American migration in some part is due to climate change, the failure of the cash-rich coffee crops in Central America. Yeah. What role is this going to play down
well,
the road?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm painting a fairly optimistic picture about migration, but the simple fact is there's still a lot of very desperate people in the world, and climate change is going to make that worse. You know, Africa, the Sahel, sub-Saharan Africa, the scramble there to control dwindling resources and just basic survival. You know, we see all the civil wars that are racking these societies. And you put climate change on top of this, that, you know, people simply, you can't subsist in these places anymore. The desert is expanding. So people are moving. You know, it's a colleague of mine, Alexander Betts at the University of Oxford in England, calls it survival migration. And there's going to be a lot of that kind of migration. I don't want to exaggerate it, but yeah, I think we will be looking at hundreds of millions of people that will be forced to move. I mean, if you look at rising sea levels, you know, in a place like Bangladesh, for example, which is a lot of it is some of it is below sea level, you know, again, you're talking about hundreds of thousands or potentially millions of people that would be displaced by this.
And you're looking at Bangladesh, which is a country that is, we thought it was one of the poorest countries in the world, and they managed to move a lot of their countrymen into almost what goes as the middle class in South Asia.
These societies are very, very resilient. They're very dynamic, even though they have been incredibly poor societies. I mean, you know, you mentioned Bangladesh as an example. There are hundreds of thousands, you know, maybe in the millions now, of Rohingya who are ethnically Bengali, mm-hmm. who've been expelled from Myanmar, of all places. And the Bangladeshis have had to step up and take care of these people. You mentioned Central America and the failure of the coffee crops there. I mean, these are places where the economy is built around a single commodity. And, you know, when you can't grow coffee anymore in some of those highland areas of Central America, people have got to go somewhere, you know, to find a way to make a living. And it's also very important to keep in mind. I mean, in a way, if you look at us in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, we are almost to the point of paranoia, worrying about, you know, people moving from the south to the north. But actually, the vast majority of movements of people and migration is in the Southern Hemisphere. So most of the migrants, the majority of them are actually in the south. They're not moving from the south to north. They're moving south to south. So, you know, if you want to talk about a migration crisis in the world today, the crisis is not so much in Europe and the United States. It's really in the Southern Hemisphere. I mean, if you look, what's the largest migration crisis in Latin America right now?
Venezuela, probably.
The Venezuelans, over 4 million Venezuelans have fled. 1.5 million of them are in Colombia, you know, trying to survive. So we do have a real migration crisis in Latin America, but it's in the south. It's in the Southern Hemisphere. You know, it is the Colombians, it's the Ecuadorians, it's the Peruvians, the Brazilians. And now, of course, those Venezuelans are coming into Central America. Some of them are coming to Panama and Costa Rica. Some of them are coming to Mexico. It won't be long before some of them will be coming to the United States as well. So this is a regional problem. It's a regional crisis. And the problem when you have, you know, this many people displaced, and the same thing we're seeing in Central America, to go back to the dispute between the U.S. and Mexico, you know, no country can solve this unilaterally. I mean, you've got to have cooperation across countries. I've been working on a task force at the Organization of American States to try to come up with an idea, a policy that can be promoted regionally in South America to deal with the Venezuelan crisis. And the situation in Venezuela doesn't appear to be getting any better. So we could see another 1, 2, 3 million Venezuelans on the move. And that's going to be the frontline states that are going to have to manage this. If you look, what's the largest immigration crisis for any country in the world today? It's in Lebanon. 1 in every 4 people in Lebanon is a refugee. And Lebanon is a tiny place. It's not that rich. And they have had to bear the brunt, you know, of the Syrian civil war, the Iraqi conflicts, and the whole fight against ISIS. So I think for us as Americans, we should think about, you know, what's, you know, the big crises that are going on in different parts of the world. And even though we've got a crisis here on our doorstep, a humanitarian crisis, you know, we should suck it up a little bit and manage this. And I think we can cope with it.
We are far from alone there. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
James Holifield, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, you're certainly welcome. I enjoyed it.
Dr. James Holifield is a professor of political science and the director of the Tower Center for Political Studies at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking about the Trump administration's migration policies. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.